Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Brian Lynn, and Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this report.
Colleges and universities in the United States have received more than $350 million from the government of Saudi Arabia over the past 10 years. Yet some of these schools are reconsidering their ties with the government following the killing of Saudi journalist and writer Jamal Khashoggi. His death has led to international criticism of the oil-rich nation. The Associated Press, or AP, examined U.S. federal records for information about the flow of Saudi money to American higher education. The news agency found that at least $354 million from the Saudi government or organizations it controls has gone to 37 American schools since 2011. Much of the money was provided through a special scholarship program. It paid tuition for Saudis studying in the United States. But AP researchers found that at least $62 million came through deals with or gifts from Saudi Arabia's nationally owned companies and research centers. Two of the U.S. schools that received the most money did so through contracts with a top Saudi research center. It is called the King Abdulaziz City for Science and Technology. It has provided $14 million to Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, since 2011. The University of California, Los Angeles, accepted $6 million from the center.
In addition, Saudi Arabia's national oil company, Saudi Aramco, has given $20 million to U.S. colleges and universities. This amount includes $9 million to Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas, and $4 million to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, in Boston. A national chemical company known as SABIC sent another $8 million to American schools. Some of the contracts ended before 2017, but questions about Khashoggi's death at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul have led some schools to reconsider current or future deals. On October 22nd, MIT announced plans to launch a swift, thorough examination of its partnerships with Saudi Arabia. The institute called Khashoggi's disappearance a serious concern. Richard Lester is a member of the school's administration. He said professors who work with Saudi Arabia can make their own decisions as to the best path forward. MIT works with Saudi universities on research projects and has a long history of working with Saudi Aramco. In March, the company promised to give $25 million to the school for research in areas such as renewable energy and artificial intelligence.
The AP attempted to speak by telephone with officials at the Saudi embassy in Washington earlier this week. It said they could not be reached for comment. Many other U.S. schools have shown no signs that they are reconsidering ties. Officials at the University of California, Berkeley, said they are not examining their financial support from Saudi Arabia. The money includes a $6 million contract to develop special technology that can be used to support renewable energy. A university spokesman said the Saudi support represents only a small part of the contracts and grants that go to the school's researchers. Other schools, including the University of Michigan, did not provide details about Saudi Arabia's financial support.
Researchers looked at records from the U.S. Department of Education's Foreign Gift and Contracts report. It lists any U.S. university that received $250,000 or more in foreign money in a given year. The self-reported information lists money provided from 2011 through 2017. The largest amounts of money came through a Saudi scholarship program that sends thousands of students to U.S. schools every year. The program provided $73 million to the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., George Mason University in nearby Fairfax, Virginia, received $63 million. The two schools said they will not refuse the scholarship money because it would cause them to reject the students it covers. George Mason admits about 250 Saudi students through the program each spring and autumn term. America's ties with Saudi Arabia have come under intense review since Khashoggi disappeared on October 2nd. President Donald Trump called it the worst cover-up ever. Activists and some U.S. politicians have called on the United States and its industries to break with the nation, and some have. Three Washington-based businesses recently canceled business deals to represent Saudi interests in the United States. Several other companies have suspended work in Saudi Arabia. One of them is owned by businessman Richard Branson.
More recently, the pressure to break ties has expanded to colleges and universities. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories.
Each week, we tell about terms and expressions we use in American English. We often explore their meanings and explain how to use them in different situations.
Today, we talk about something common to everyone around the world. Laughing is one of life's most simple pleasures. It is free. You can do it anywhere, and it makes you feel good.
Like the flu, laughter can spread easily among people. Often when we hear someone laughing in a crowded room or a packed train, for example, we start laughing too, even if we have no idea why.
But unlike the flu, even a good hand washing will not protect you against breaking into a fit of laughter. Your eyes water, your heart rate goes up, and your face gets that beautiful laughter glow. In fact, many doctors say that mental health can affect physical health. You might even say, laughter is the best medicine.
However, laughter is the best medicine does not mean that you should not take medicine when you are sick. It simply means that having a positive outlook might help ease your troubles. People who use this expression are probably pretty happy people. Then there are those other types. You know, people who are always grumpy. We could call someone who does not like to laugh a curmudgeon. A curmudgeon is bad-tempered, ill-natured, and just generally not fun to be around.
Well, unless you yourself are a curmudgeon. If that is the case, you two could hang out and not laugh and not have fun together. You know what we say, misery loves company. This means that some people who are miserable and unhappy like to make others miserable and unhappy too. On the other hand, making others laugh with you is an act of joy and kindness. However, the opposite is true when people laugh at you. That experience is lonely and no fun at all. But at least those two phrases really show the importance of choosing the right preposition.
For example, if Anna is in a funny play and people laugh with her, that is a good thing. However, if she messes up her lines and falls on stage, people may laugh at her, and that is not so good. People might even call her a laughingstock. No one, not even a professional comedian, wants to be a laughingstock. It may be difficult, but if you have the choice to laugh or cry, choose laughter. For one thing, you may inspire others to laugh too.
That's right. As we also like to say, laugh and the world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. This means that people prefer to be around those who are happy and cheerful.
Ella Wheeler Wilcox, a poet of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, penned this famous expression. In her poem, Solitude, she writes, "Laugh, and the world laughs with you. Weep, and you weep alone."
However, these days, we do not usually say weep. So the expression now uses the word cry. Whatever you call it, weeping or crying, it is always better to laugh. And that's Words and Their Stories.
I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Richard Nixon. Nixon is well known to many Americans for one reason. He was the only president to resign from the position. Facing possible legal action by Congress, Nixon left office early in his second term. Yet Nixon's early political career was marked by success. He also had some noteworthy achievements during his White House years. And he attained his goal of moving the government in a more conservative direction. In his later years, Nixon and his supporters tried to reclaim his place as an expert on international affairs. But for many Americans, the name Nixon remains linked to distrust of national leaders, abuse of power, and political wrongdoing. Richard Nixon had a difficult early life. He was the second of five sons in a Quaker family. His parents owned a lemon ranch in California, near the city of Los Angeles. But the family struggled financially, and two of Richard's brothers died, one as a small child and one as a young adult. In time, his parents' business failed, and the Nixons moved to a nearby town. The parents and children all worked at a filling station that sold fuel and other products. Despite the many hours he worked at the store, Richard Nixon was a top student in high school. He was offered financial aid to attend Harvard University, but the family needed even more money to send him there. Instead, he attended a local college, where he became the student body president, joined a debate team, acted in the theater, and played football. Nixon went on to law school at Duke University in North Carolina. Even with his impressive background, he did not get the jobs he sought at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, or top law offices. So he returned to the California town where he grew up and began working as a lawyer. There, he married another actor at the community theater. Her name was Thelma Ryan, but she was called Pat. The Nixons went on to have two daughters, Tricia and Julie. In 1942, Nixon accepted a job with the federal government in Washington, D.C. He did not stay in the position long. After the United States entered World War II, Nixon joined the Navy. He served as an officer in the Pacific. When he returned to the U.S., Republican Party officials asked him to be a candidate for Congress. Nixon agreed. He won two terms in the House of Representatives, and then a seat in the U.S. Senate. 2 years later, Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican presidential candidate, asked Nixon to be his vice president. The two men won in an electoral landslide, and in 1953, Nixon took office as vice president. He was only 40 years old, the second youngest vice president in U.S. history. Nixon's early political career is remembered for several reasons. One is how quickly he rose to high government office. Another is for his part in the Alger Hiss case in the late 1940s. Hiss was a top official in the State Department. He was accused of being a communist in the 1930s and 1940s, and of passing information about the U.S. government to Soviet spies. Hiss denied the accusations. The case was big news in the United States. It showed the clash between people who believed Hiss was falsely accused as a way to discredit liberal policies and people who believed the government was protecting communist sympathizers. Nixon was in the second group. He was part of the investigation against Hiss and pushed for his indictment. Nixon's efforts succeeded, and Hiss went to jail for almost 4 years. Later, Nixon said that the case was one of the reasons for his rise to power. Nixon also earned national attention with an event that has become known as the Checkers Speech. It happened in 1952, when Nixon was running for vice president. Some reporters accused Nixon of corruption. They said he was accepting money and gifts from wealthy donors in exchange for his political support. Nixon went on television to deny the claims personally. At the time, Americans were not used to seeing politicians speaking directly to the public. Yet Nixon spoke informally and emotionally from what appeared to be a home. He explained his family's finances. He said he did not accept campaign donations for personal benefit. But he added there was one exception. A supporter had once given the Nixon children a black and white dog they called Checkers. Nixon said he refused to return his daughter's pet. The public and Republican Party officials loved the speech. Nixon appeared warm and likable. Middle-class Americans especially said they could relate to him. most forgot the claims against him, and Nixon's political career was saved. During the following 8 years, he served as vice president in the Eisenhower administration. But then, Nixon's luck turned. In 1960, Nixon lost as a presidential candidate to John F. Kennedy. He blamed, in part, the media. Then in 1962, he lost his efforts to be governor of California. Nixon said he was retiring from politics. He famously told reporters, "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore." Yet, 7 years later, he was in the White House. It was one of the most memorable comebacks in U.S. political history. When Nixon took office in 1969, some Americans thought the country was in crisis. The economy was not doing well. Race riots had been erupting in big cities. Many people were still trying to recover from the violence of a year earlier. Civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. and President John F. Kennedy's brother Robert had both been shot and killed. Pollution of the environment was becoming a major political issue, women were pressing for equal rights, and many Americans continued to protest American involvement in Vietnam. Nixon took action. During his first years in office, he supported reforms and rules to improve the economy, protect the environment, increase workplace and other opportunities for women, support civil rights, and, in his words, bring peace with honor in Vietnam. But for the most part, Nixon did not have the support of Congress to enact legislation. So he expanded the power of the presidency to carry out his goals. He is remembered especially for three foreign policy moves. In 1972, he visited China, with which the U.S. government had tense relations since the Chinese Communist Party took power. As the Alger Hiss case showed, Nixon was strongly anti-communist, but he made establishing diplomatic relations between the two sides possible again. He also visited the Soviet Union and was the first U.S. president to visit Moscow. Nixon and the Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev, agreed to limit the growth of nuclear arms. Their actions helped ease tensions at a time when U.S. officials were worried about the expansion of communism. And Nixon did succeed in reaching a peace agreement with North Vietnamese leaders. In 1973, American troops slowly began to leave the country, although fighting there continued. Nixon's foreign policy achievements helped him in the 1972 election campaign. His first presidential election had been extremely close. The second he won by one of the widest electoral vote margins in U.S. history. Even though he was popular with voters, Nixon had been concerned about his political future. Nixon was so worried that, before the election, he created a secret team to prevent any damaging information from reaching the media. Later, its job expanded to include investigating any information that might hurt his public image. About 5 months before Election Day, five men broke into the opposition party's headquarters at the Watergate, a hotel and office complex in Washington, D.C. The team had already stolen copies of secret campaign documents. Now, in the middle of the night, the men were trying to add listening equipment to the telephones, in other words, spy on the opposition. But a security guard became suspicious and called the police. The men were caught and arrested. When the story came to light, Nixon publicly denied that any White House officials were involved in the crime. But in time, the public learned that Nixon was lying. In fact, he assisted with payments to the men who were arrested. And he tried to use the Central Intelligence Agency to block an FBI investigation of the crime. Nixon knew that the Watergate break-in was only part of the illegal or questionable acts he could be held responsible for. Later, people connected with Nixon told investigators that the president had taped everything that happened in his office. Investigators demanded the tapes. They would prove how much Nixon knew about the illegal operations. The president refused. He dismissed the lead investigator. Two other Justice Department officials resigned in protest. A new investigator was appointed. And the U.S. Supreme Court ordered Nixon to release the tapes. At the same time, the House of Representatives voted to remove Nixon from office. They charged him with obstructing justice, abusing his power, covering up a crime, and violating the Constitution. Finally, Nixon released the tapes. But before the Senate could hold a trial, in which the president would almost certainly be found guilty, Richard Nixon resigned. He left the White House the following day. Nixon lived for 20 more years. He wrote a number of books, traveled, spent time with his family, and offered foreign policy advice to other leaders. He continued to deny that he had done anything criminal as president. Instead, Nixon said he had made bad decisions. And he did not go to trial. The next president, Gerald Ford, used his power to pardon Nixon for all offenses against the United States. But Nixon's image was permanently damaged. Most people found evidence in the tapes that Nixon knew about a related series of crimes, commonly known as Watergate. They also found that some of his public statements were dishonest. They said he made them to forward his own political goals, not to further the public good. As a result, Nixon's place in U.S. history is generally thought to be a troubled one. To be sure, he made a number of positive accomplishments, both within the U.S. and internationally. But his presidency left the country shaken. When Ford replaced him as president, he said to Americans, "Our long national nightmare is over." I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
This is